Reclaiming Christianity, Episode 7, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. Reclaiming Christianity is graciously supported by our patrons. Check us out at patreon.com/John Weldy. Hello again, friends, and welcome to Reclaiming Christianity, the only Christian podcast where the host doesn't wear pants. I am your host, John Weldy, he who does not wear pants. And I am just a guy. I say that every week, that I'm just a guy, because I don't have a pedigree like so many more. There was some friends of mine that launched a podcast just this past week, and they did it right. You know, they're all authors. There's a few of them. They're authors, and they got together their audiences and got them all together and got them to follow the podcast. And they have bumpers and they have segments and I don't do any of that stuff. I'm just a random guy talking, you know? And if you love me, you love me. And if you hate me, you hate me. If you don't know who the hell I am, you don't know who the hell I am. And that's fine. That's perfectly fine with me. And the reason that I do that is because I want to empower and encourage you to do what I do. I mean, this is something that I get this from Jesus, because this is the way that Jesus taught. Yeah, ancient rabbis, when they would teach, they weren't concerned with exactly what you did or what you knew or what they were concerned with. Can he do what I do? Can this person do what I do? And that's how they chose their apprentices. And what Jesus went in and did is he picked the kids that weren't good enough, the kids that got cut, the kids who were picked last. And man, I know about that. I don't know about you guys, but I certainly know about being picked last. And so that's what I want to encourage in all of you that are listening to this also. Maybe there's just a few people listening to this, and that's fine. I'm fine with a small audience. I'm fine with a big audience. What I'm not fine with is selling out. That's because that's not who I am. And so a chief goal of what I do is I want you to be able to do what I do. So I don't want to make it really, really hard. I want to show you. The biggest compliment that you can give me is like, well, it wasn't really anything special. I mean, I could do that. That's awesome. Yes, you could. Yes, you could. So please do that. Please do what I do. I would love that. And I would love to listen to your podcast. If you want to talk back to me, I know there's a lot of ideas that I put out, and some of them you might be screaming into the speakers. You just wanted to talk back to me. If you want to talk back to me, go to reclaimingchristianity.net, or you can send me an email at johnweldy@gmail.com. So I'm going to tell you, this episode that I'm going to be doing tonight, and I'm recording this right now on a Wednesday evening. That's when I've been doing each of my recordings. And this episode, I'm pretty intimidated about this episode. This is a big episode that's been kind of building for a while. This book, Sapiens, by Yuval Noah Harari, is an amazing, amazing tome. It's not a Christian book, and honestly, I don't intend to do all Christian books. I mean, I'm a Christian. That's who I am. That's part of my identity. And even though some people don't say, no, he's not a Christian. Yeah, I'm a Christian. That's who I am. And I call the podcast Reclaiming Christianity because I want to reclaim it not just personally for myself, but I also think Christianity has lost the story. We've lost the story, and I want to help reclaim what Christianity was originally intended to be. We have merged with empire, and we're going to talk about that quite a bit in this episode about Christianity merging with empire. And so I don't plan on doing a whole lot of quote-unquote Christian books, whatever that means exactly. But I like books of all different kinds, and this book that we're going to talk about today is a history book, and it's a brief history of humankind. And literally in this book, Yuval Noah Harari, who is an Israeli historian, doctorate in history, I can't remember the university that he teaches at in Israel, but he literally goes through the history of Homo sapiens from prehistory through written history up until modern day. And I'm so excited because the ebook that I got of this has got not only Sapiens, his first book, but also Homo Deus, his second book, which starts extending more the last chapter of Sapiens. I mean, he starts out literally Big Bang, evolution, coming into Homo sapiens through other different breeds of humans, or other different breeds of Homo species, or genus, I guess I should say. This is a lot of this is new stuff to me. I'm more of a generalist. I'm gonna make mistakes in here. I can guarantee you that. But that's one of the things that really intimidates me about this is because this is a big epic thing to be talking about, and I've been kind of building it up for the past several weeks here, and I finally finished the book this past week. It's a huge tome that is so interesting on so many levels, and like I've been talking about with the Marcus Borg book, Speaking Christian, and like I talked about with the Rob Bell book, Love Wins, I'm sure that this is not going to be the only time that I go over this book. I'm sure that this is the first episode that talks about the book Sapiens. I'm sure I'll talk about it among other episodes because things all tie together. That's the thing. When you learn, when you open yourself up to learning and finding out things about the world, man, guys, when you read, and I shouldn't just say guys because that limits me to a male perspective. Friends, when you read, it opens up so many things. Just find something you're interested in. Find a book about it. Find music about it. Find art about it. Find a documentary about it. Get into stuff. I mean, reading, yeah. When I say reading, I don't just mean reading. I mean, reading is great. I love reading, but educate yourself. Education is so much bigger than reading. Travel. Listen to lectures. Find things out from people. Learning is a lifetime thing, and it's amazing how many things come together when we really dedicate ourselves to learning. And so I want to start out in this episode with something that's really on my mind. And this week, the big thing in the news is the NFL protests. And so this is what's going on. If you're hearing this far away from the time period when it's happening, I'll explain a little bit of what's going on, because just about everybody right now that knows anything about current events or social media is completely enveloped by this NFL protest thing right now. So what's going on? It was started by Colin Kaepernick about a year ago, and Colin Kaepernick, quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, does not have a job right now. This issue actually cost him his job, and so he decided that because of the injustice, the racial injustice in the world, especially, well, in this country, I should say, Colin Kaepernick decided that he was going to protest that, and he started out by sitting on the bench while the national anthem was going. I mean, the national anthem is really big at every American sporting event that there is. They play the national anthem before everything. You know, they're expected to stand. And this is honestly, this is like many, many, many things when you start studying history. Even though we in this country tend to have a very short attention span and a very short memory. And this is actually part of the artifacting of a society that doesn't read. Really, literally, the society is getting kind of post-literate in a way. That's why I think reading is such a very good thing. George Lucas in the Star Wars saga decided that he was not going to have any written materials in the Star Wars saga, and it was only going to be video and audio recordings and things. And, you know, they're very impermanent. You can't just go back and look at it again. I mean, you could watch it again, you know, and it's a little, but it changes it changes the way the world works. And so he decided that he was going to have a world that had a very short attention span, a very short memory. And within a generation, things could be forgotten, you know, and honestly, that's how I've talked before on this podcast about how that's how it was with so many things in the early years of Christianity. When the powerful people got a hold of things they didn't agree with, they completely destroyed all of the writings. And within a generation or two, those things were almost completely forgotten about. And that's kind of the same thing that we do when we have a post-literate society that depends on things like television and Facebook and TV news, you know, and newspapers, magazines, you know, all this short-term media instead of books, which are more permanent. Now, the other side of that, at the same time, when you post something on the internet, it's there forever. I mean, that's what we tell our kids, you know. So it's kind of this strange place that we're in, but we kind of have forgotten that this thing of the NFL standing up for the national anthem and being the players being out there for the national anthem is a very recent thing. I don't know exact. I've heard that it was as recent as the 2000s that it only started. I could be wrong about that, but it is a recent thing. It's not something that has always been a part of the NFL. And obviously, the NFL only stretches back about 50 years, not very long in and of itself. So it's not like it's this grand tradition that's existed forever. But Colin Kaepernick decided to sit out the anthem, not because he hated America, but because he couldn't bear with what was going on with racial injustice, with so many. If you look at the statistics, I want to guide you to an amazing documentary on Netflix called 13th. The 13th Amendment was the amendment that freed the slaves. And in this documentary, it shows how what we basically have done is the slavery culture never really ended. And it's a painful, painful thing to watch, but it goes through the years since the end of the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation, and about apartheid, or not apartheid, but about how the country was so separate and the separate but equal, segregation, that's what I'm looking for, you know. And then when segregation was even deemed illegal, you know, that you couldn't segregate anymore, it's all over the prison population. The war on drugs, really, what it effectively turned into was a war on Black America. And there's many, many reasons, and there's many things. I encourage you to look at that documentary and see their reasoning behind it and see if you agree or disagree. I mean, you may disagree, and that would be perfectly fine. You know, but don't just accept what somebody tells just because I'm saying it. You know, that's a bold statement, saying that the war on drugs in the 80s was essentially a war on Black America, and that the prison populations right now are the new slavery. That's a very bold statement. But that's the assertion that this documentary makes, and it's absolutely fantastic. And so those type of things, and the police brutality, how it always just happens to be against people of color, and how people of color are treated differently in this country, like second-class citizens, and how people of color never seem to have justice. These stories, and it's so easy for me as a white cisgender male, as a straight white male, a Christian, it's so easy for me to overlook these things. And it's so easy for me because I have struggles in my life all the time. And it's so easy for me to say, oh, there's struggles all around. But we don't understand some of the obstacles that people of color deal with in this country. And so this is what Colin Kaepernick decided to protest. And it turned into, well, there's two sides to it. And right now it's grown. It's grown to where, Colin Kaepernick first did this last year under the Obama administration. And President Trump has now brought this to national attention. And the whole NFL has gotten into it right now. And there's two sides to this. We're a divided country. There's the side that I was just talking about with the racial injustice and what people are trying to say. And then the other side tries to come in and say it's disrespectful to soldiers. And a lot of people, there's a lot of people that I've talked to that are saying, well, I'm not hearing anybody that's saying what the protest is actually about. I don't think it's a very good protest because I'm not hearing anybody say what it's actually about. All I'm hearing is what people are saying about disrespecting the flag, disrespecting the veterans, disrespecting the country. And this really goes, there's a lot of different directions you could take this. There's a lot of things that you could think about in this. One of the things that I'm really noticing as I study more and more history a big part of it is this book that I'm going to talk about today. But I'm also watching a series now. This name may shock some of you a little bit. Oliver Stone. I'm watching a documentary series right now that he's doing. Like that. It's called the History of America or the Secret History of America or something like that. It's on Netflix also, and it's absolutely incredible. Now, Oliver Stone, I growing up as a fundamentalist, conservative Baptist boy in the Midwest, I was always taught, oh, Oliver Stone, he's a conspiracy theorist. Now, the thing is, as I have educated myself more and more in the past few years, and as I have started looking into church history and world history and U.S. history, I see more and more. I'm seeing a lot more. Now, you may disagree with me. You may think that Oliver Stone is a complete crackpot conspiracy theorist, and that's okay if that's what you think, but I don't see it. I think the dude makes sense. I'm not going to say I agree with it. There should never be anybody that you say, I agree with everything that they say. You know, don't just accept things that people say. Take them through your filter. Listen to the things that make sense and get rid of the things that don't make sense, you know, but have a broad knowledge base. Listen to things that you don't think you're going to agree with, because every once in a while you're going to come up against something and say, wow, I learned something that I never thought I was going to learn. And so I'm seeing a lot of themes within church history and world history and U.S. history, and so much of it is tied in and enmeshed together, and there's so much empire that's in all of it. One of the things that really makes me sick is how tied together right now are the cross and the flag. The cross and the flag are so tied together right now in our American culture that it's quite frightening. There are countries throughout world history that have been called theocracies that I think might be less so than what we are today, right now, which is a frightening thing. I think there's a lot of, as you look at ancient worship rituals, and as you look at the rituals that have power today, we worship the flag. We really do worship the flag. And that's what's going on in this disturbance with so many NFL players, people of color, I mean, really, if you think about, where do people of color have a voice in America? They have a voice in professional sports. Where else? Oh, some of them have a voice in Hollywood, a few authors, a few politicians. But really, the biggest place that people of color have a voice in this country are in professional sports. So why wouldn't they use that voice? The thing that the conservative side keeps bringing up with, oh, it's okay to protest. It's okay to we understand what's going on with that, but not by disrespecting the soldier. You can't do it by disrespecting the soldier. That's off limits because those people died and served for our country. And I've really been thinking about that hard. I've really been thinking about this with this idea of disrespecting the soldier. And I really, because there's few things in this country that are off limits. We were founded upon the principles that every man is equal. Now, once again, the original Constitution did say man, and they did mean man, and they didn't mean every man. They meant every white landowner is equal. But the words are in the Constitution that every man is equal, and we were founded on the idea of equality, and we've, at the very least, that's been an ideal that we've been working towards, and it's something that we're hoping for. There is a hope to it. And there are very few things in this country that are off limit. We have free speech. You can say just about anything that you want to say. There are very few things that are off limits, but it seems like this thing of disrespecting the soldier is off limits. And I've really tried to think about why. Why is it that disrespecting the soldier is so off limits in this country? And so I was thinking through, back in episode 2 of this podcast, I read a book called Flickering Pixels, How Technology Shapes Our Faith. And it really gets you thinking about how the media is the message. The message of a television show that you're watching is not whatever the content is. The message is the television itself. The message of a church service is not whatever the pastor is saying. The message is that the pastor is up there talking, and there's 300 people staring right at him, shutting up and listening. So often in our society, the media is the message. And if you want more details about that, I encourage you to go back and look at episode 2, Flickering Pixels, episode 2 of this podcast, or read the book Flickering Pixels by Shane Hipps. It's an amazing, amazing book. So what is the media of the American soldier? What does the American soldier stand for? Why is the American soldier so off limits? Well, if you think about the American soldier, you think about our military. Our military is very authoritarian, extremely authoritarian. It has to be. It's very hierarchical. When you get orders in the military from somebody above you, you must follow that order or there are extreme consequences. This is a much different system than civilian system. Civilian system, if your boss tells you to do something, well, you may do it, you may not do it, you may do it a little bit different way. I mean, there's an ideal of being the rebel that's throughout all of our media, throughout all of our stories. I mean, Americans, we love being the rebel, right? But you don't have that in the military. The military is completely different. The military is built on, founded on authoritarianism. The military is also founded on power. The military is about empire. The military is how we gain so much power in this country. We spend more money on our military than any other country. In fact, some of the graphs that I've seen, we spend more money on our military in this country than the next 8 countries combined. We are number 1 on the list, and you add up 2 through 9, and we spend more than them. The military spending is out of control. That's absolutely central to who we are. And that's honestly, that's the message I'm talking about Oliver Stone's documentary series. That's a big message in there, too. He talks about the atom bomb and how we achieve power through the atom bomb and military arming. And it's amazing. I really encourage you to check out that series. I'm only halfway through it myself, but it's absolutely wonderful. But that's really where we are. That's really what the message of the American soldier is. It's authoritarianism, power, empire. The soldier represents the empire. But above all that, the authoritarianism, the pyramid-shaped power structure, which is the same thing we deal with in the church, obviously. This is why church and nation are tied together so much at this moment in history. Because we have the same structure. And the people that have that structure in the church system are the people who most press for that structure in the national system. They tend to be the people who most press for that structure in supporting the military. I mean, obviously, the Republicans, the conservatives, are the ones that push for a stronger military, and the Democrats, the liberals, are the ones that push away from military more. And simple fact is that 81% of evangelical Christians voted for Donald Trump. That's how we got where we are right now. So it's a central piece, the American soldier, it's a central piece of the story of half of our nation. We know that we're a severely divided nation right now, more than we have been ever in the course of history. And it's been that way since at least 2000. It's been that way for the past 17 years. And one side of the story is very much into this authoritarianism, which is why it's not okay to disrespect the soldier, which is why they see that that's the central issue of this. And that's so strong on their radar that they cannot see that what's really being talked about is something completely different. And they cannot even see that Mr. Kaepernick and the rest of the people that have gone into this with eyes wide open, what they're really doing is meant to support, to honor that tradition of the military. Because it started out with Mr. Kaepernick sitting out during the national anthem. But he spoke to a veteran, and he listened to that veteran, and that veteran was not happy. Now, some veterans say you need to respect the flag, and some veterans say, I fought for your right to free speech. You do whatever you feel. And I've heard many stories on both sides of that, and I'm not going to say which one is right. This is the nice thing about being an American, is you can have your own opinion. But Mr. Kaepernick, the story that I've heard, Mr. Kaepernick and his early adopters specifically chose the kneeling position because they want to show their bodies at half-mast. It's like a country under duress. It's like when you fly your flag at half-mast. They still want to honor the flag, but they want to show, we got problems, guys. So, I wasn't exactly sure. That was one of the things. These are big ideas. I mean, when you talk about the soldier, I'm not going to say that it's all evil. It's not. It's absolutely not. I mean, Jesus said, greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. And absolutely, we see soldiers do that all the time. But Jesus did not say, greater love has no man than this, that a man lay his life down for his country. This idea of nationalism that we are so embroiled in, this is what has really driven this country, and it's driven so many countries around the world, but it's really what's driven America to be the only remaining superpower, is because we're better than everybody, and we know it, right? I mean, that's what we say, at least. That's what we think, and that's the picture that the world has about us, that we're full of ourselves. And the really interesting thing, and this is why I chose to do this book for this episode, is the idea of a nation. Nations don't exist. It's just a story. These borders that we put up and say, right here, this is America, this is Mexico, this is Canada. We just make these things up. There's nothing inherently different about these places. It's just a story that we make up and we decide to follow. And that's going to get me into the book. I'm hoping I'm not too far in right now because my last couple episodes have been getting kind of long. And this chapter that I want to read is rather long. But this is what Yuval Noah Harari talks about in his book Sapiens. And this is the chapter that I want to read. It's called The Tree of Knowledge. And it talks about stories and the shared stories that we have and how much power the shared stories have over us. Specifically in the development, it's talking about the cognitive revolution. Without these stories, we would not hold together as a society. Without these stories, we would be no different than cows, pigs, lions. Before we had these stories, before we had the cognitive revolution, mankind, Homo sapien, was not the highest on the food chain. But these stories help hold us together. And so I'm going to start getting into this book a little bit. And you know, if you've listened to this podcast before, you know the drill. You know that I call it book reviews and commentary. And the book review is always, I love this book. It's amazing. But I will say specifically for this book, there's a few books. I know I've said that. I'm only 7 episodes in, and I know I've said this several times about several books already. But this is I absolutely adore this book. It's wonderful. I will say that it's one of my favorites. Even though I only recently got into this book, it's a chunk. It is a thick chunk to get through. And I'm not just talking about the length of the book. I'm talking about how dense it is, how many ideas that will really stretch you and pull you in different directions you've gone before. It will help you think outside the box in different ways. Think of different things. Think of history. It's got me interested in history. I never cared about history. If you asked me 5 years ago if I care about history, I don't care about history. This book, and also, of course, my love of church history, finding out what really happened, find out what's going on, it has really ignited a passion for history inside of me. And I think any book that can get you more interested in a subject matter and want to learn more and more, I think that's absolutely fantastic. So this is chapter 2, The Tree of Knowledge. And the drill in this podcast is that I will interrupt myself sometimes. I'm probably going to interrupt myself because this chapter is longer. I do want to get through it all. I don't want to stop in the middle like I have in some other episodes. I want to read this entire chapter. I will probably stop myself less than I usually do, but there still will be times that I stop myself, and it will be I will let you know when it's me talking instead of when it's the author talking. So this is chapter 2 of Sapiens, The Tree of Knowledge. In the previous chapter, we saw that although sapiens had already populated East Africa 150,000 years ago, they began to overrun the rest of planet Earth and drive the other human species to extinction only about 70,000 years ago. In the intervening millennia, even though these archaic sapiens looked just like us and their brains were just as big as ours, they did not enjoy any marked advantage over other human species, did not produce particularly sophisticated tools, and did not accomplish any other special feats. In fact, in the first recorded encounter between sapiens and Neanderthals, the Neanderthals won. About 100,000 years ago, some sapien groups migrated north to the Levant, which was Neanderthal territory, but failed to secure a firm footing. It might have been due to nasty natives, an inclement climate, or unfamiliar local parasites. Whatever the reason, the sapiens eventually retreated, leaving the Neanderthals as masters of the Middle East. Now, this is John talking here. The Neanderthals were physically superior to the Homo sapiens. From an animal perspective, there's no reason the Neanderthals would not win. Okay, back to the text. This poor record of achievement has led scholars to speculate that these internal structure of the brains of these sapiens was probably different from ours. They look like us, but their cognitive abilities, learning, remembering, communicating, were far more limited. Teaching such an ancient sapiens English, persuading him of getting the truth of Christian dogma, or getting him to understand the theory of evolution would probably have been a hopeless undertaking. Conversely, we would have had a very hard time learning his language and understanding his way of thinking. But then again, Beginning about 70,000 years ago, Homo sapiens started doing very special things. Around that date, sapiens bands left Africa for a second time. This time they drove the Neanderthals and all other human species not only from the Middle East, but from the face of the earth. Within a remarkably short period, sapiens reached Europe and East Asia. About 45,000 years ago, they somehow crossed the open sea and landed in Australia, a continent hitherto untouched by humans. The period from about 70,000 years ago to about 30,000 years ago witnessed the invention of boats, oil lamps, bows and arrows, and needles essential for sewing warm clothing. The first objects that can reliably be called art date from this era, as does the first clear evidence for religion, commerce, and social stratification. Most researchers believe that these unprecedented accomplishments were the product of a revolution in sapiens' cognitive abilities. They maintain that the people who drove the Neanderthals to extinction, settled Australia, and carved the statal lion man were as intelligent, creative, and sensitive as we are. If we were to come across the artists of the Stadel Cave, we would learn their language and they ours. We'd be able to explain to them everything we know, from the adventures of Alice in Wonderland to the paradoxes of quantum physics, and they could teach us how their people view the world. The appearance of new ways of thinking and communicating between 70,000 and 30,000 years ago constitutes the cognitive revolution. What caused it, we're not sure. The most commonly believed theory argues that accidental genetic mutations changed the inner wirings of the brains of sapiens, enabling them to think in unprecedented ways and to communicate using an altogether new type of language. We might call it the tree of knowledge mutations. Why did it occur in sapiens' DNA rather than that of Neanderthals? It was a matter of pure chance, as far as we can tell. But it's more important to understand the consequences of the tree of knowledge mutation than its causes. What was so special about the new sapiens language that it enabled us to conquer the world? It was not the first language. Every animal has some kind of language. Even insects, such as bees and ants, know how to communicate in sophisticated ways, informing one another of the whereabouts of food. Neither was it the first vocal language. Many animals, including all ape and monkey species, have vocal languages. For example, green monkeys use calls of various kinds to communicate. Zoologists have identified one call that means careful, an eagle. A slightly different warns careful, a lion. When researchers played a recording of the first call to a group of monkeys, the monkeys stopped what they were doing and looked upwards in fear. When the same group heard a recording of the second call, the lion warning, they quickly scrambled up a tree. Sapiens can produce many more distinct sounds than green monkeys, but whales and elephants have equally impressive abilities. A parrot can say anything Albert Einstein could say, as well as mimicking the sounds of phones ringing, doors slamming, and sirens wailing. Whatever advantage Einstein had over a parrot, it was not vocal. What then is so special about our language? The most common answer is that our language is amazingly supple. We can connect a limited number of sounds and signs to produce an infinite number of sentences, each with a distinct meaning. We can thereby ingest, store, and communicate a prodigious amount of information about the surrounding world. A green monkey can yell to its comrades, "Careful, a lion!" But a modern human can tell her friends that this morning near the bend in the river she saw a lion tracking a herd of bison. She can then describe the exact location, including the different paths leading to the area. With this information, the members of her band can put their heads together and discuss whether they should approach the river, chase away the lion, and hunt the bison. A second theory agrees that our unique language evolved as a means of sharing information about the world, but the most important information that needed to be conveyed was about humans, not about lions or bison. Our language evolved as a way of gossiping. According to this theory, Homo sapiens is primarily a social animal. Social cooperation is our key for survival and reproduction. It is not enough for individual men and women to know the whereabouts of lions and bison. It's much more important for them to know who in their band hates whom, who is sleeping with whom, who is honest, and who is a cheat. The amount of information that one must obtain and store in order to track the ever-changing relationships of even a few dozen individuals is staggering. In a band of 50 individuals, there are 1,225 one-on-one relationships and countless more complex social combinations. All apes show a keen interest in such social information, but they have trouble gossiping effectively. Neanderthals and archaic Homo sapiens probably also had a hard time talking behind each other's backs, a much maligned ability which is in fact essential for cooperation in large numbers. The new linguistic skills that modern sapiens acquired about 70 millennia ago enabled them to gossip for hours on end. Reliable information about who could be trusted meant that small bands could expand into larger bands, and sapiens could develop tighter and more sophisticated types of communication. The gossip theory might sound like a joke, but numerous studies support it. Even today, the vast majority of human communication, whether in the form of emails, phone calls, or newspaper columns, is gossip. It comes so naturally to us that it seems as if our language evolved for this very purpose. Do you think that history professors chat about the reasons for World War I when they meet for lunch? Or that nuclear physicists spend their coffee breaks at scientific conferences talking about quarks? Sometimes. But more often, they gossip about the professor who caught her husband cheating. Or the quarrel between the head of the department and the dean, or the rumors that a colleague used his research funds to buy a Lexus. Gossip usually focuses on wrongdoings. Rumor mongers are the original fourth estate, journalists who inform society about and thus protect it from cheats and freeloaders. Most likely, both the gossip theory and the there is a lion near the river theory are valid. Yet the truly unique feature of our language is not its ability to transmit information about men and lions. Rather, it's the ability to transmit information about things that do not exist at all. As far as we know, only sapiens can talk about entire kinds of entities that they have never seen, touched, or smelled. Legends, myths, gods, and religions appeared for the first time with the cognitive revolution. Many animals and human species could previously say, "Careful, a lion." Thanks to the cognitive revolution, Homo sapiens acquired the ability to say, "The lion is the guardian spirit of our tribe." This ability to speak about factions is the most unique feature of sapiens language. It's relatively easy to agree that only Homo sapiens can speak about things that don't really exist and believe six impossible things before breakfast. You could never convince a monkey to give you a banana by promising him limitless bananas after death in monkey heaven. But why is it important? Oh, I love that sentence. I'm going to read that again. You could never convince a monkey to give you a banana by promising him limitless bananas after death in monkey heaven. But why is it important? After all, fiction can be dangerously misleading or distracting. People who go to the forest looking for fairies and unicorns would seem to have less chance of survival than people who go looking for mushrooms and deer. And if you spend hours praying to non-existing guardian spirits, aren't you wasting precious time better spent foraging, fighting, and fornicating? But fiction has enabled us not merely to imagine things, but to do so collectively. We can weave common myths, such as the biblical creation story, the Dreamtime myths of Aboriginal Australians, and the nationalist myths of modern states. Such myths give sapiens the unprecedented ability to cooperate flexibly in large numbers. Ants and bees can also work together in huge numbers, but they do so in a very rigid manner and only with close relatives. Wolves and chimpanzees cooperate far more flexibly than ants, but they can only do so with small numbers of other individuals that they know intimately. Sapiens can cooperate in extremely flexible ways with countless numbers of strangers. That's why sapiens rule the world, whereas ants eat our leftovers and chimps are locked up in zoos and research laboratories. So this was really, really, this is John talking right now. This was really, really interesting to me when I first read it. Because any time that I've heard about why humanity rules the world, well, looking at our world today, we think about, oh, it's obviously technology. Because we have technology that is greater than the animals, obviously, the technology of agriculture, the technology of tools, the technology of weapons, and then the people among us, the groups who control other groups of people, the United States, who is above all groups of people, the reason why we're there is because of technology. With the United States, it's our military. That's why we're there, whether they're actively used or whether they're a deterrent. It is our military buildup, the amount of money that we spend into conventional military, into technological military, into atomic military, that is the reason why we are on the top of the heap right now. And that's any time that I've heard of sapiens and why sapiens are on the top of the heap, it's been about tools. It's focused on tools. But I love how he's talking about, no, it's about our language. And he specifically talks about it because it lets us have common stories. Now, he uses this word myth. And I realize when you're in a Christian background or any kind of a religious background, especially a fundamentalist background, the word myth has a lot of negative connotations. But that's not how myth is used here. That's not how myth is. Now, he obviously, Yuval Noah Harari is not a believer. He's not a Christian. He's not a religious believer. He's not a Jew. Well, he's a Jew as a nationalism. You know, he's an ethnic Jew, but he's not a religious Jew. He's not a believer in God or the supernatural. However, I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. So this idea of myth, a myth is not something that's not true. It's not a story that is fictional. So this is one thing that I've really learned from reading authors like Marcus Borg and Joseph Campbell and, you know, Yuval Noah Harari, is that the word myth doesn't mean falsehood. Myths are true not because they actually happened, not because they have a historicity behind them, but myths are true because the power of the story, because they represent something that's a timeless truth. The myths of the Greek gods, Aesop's fables. It's really easy for Christians to say, oh, these things, there's truth in these things, there are morals in these things, but they're not quote-unquote true. But once we see that pointed to our own Bible, it's much harder for us to accept that. But this is indeed what I have come to accept. There are many things in the Hebrew Bible and also the Christian Bible, what we call the Old and the New Testaments, but especially in the Hebrew Bible, that I very much question the historicity of right now, today. But I do not question the truth. I have no problem myself calling many parts of the Hebrew Bible myth, maybe even some parts of the Christian Bible. I have no problem calling them myth, and I don't think, and I don't have any problem questioning the historicity of many of the things. I don't think in most things. There are some things where the historicity, I believe, is important. But truth is much bigger than historicity. Let's go back to the text. The legend of Pugiat. Our chimpanzee cousins usually live in small troops of several dozen individuals. They form close friendships, hunt together, and fight shoulder to shoulder against baboons, cheetahs, and enemy chimpanzees. Their social structure tends to be hierarchical. Their dominant member, who is always a male, is termed the alpha male. Other males and females exhibit their submission to the alpha male by bowing before him while making grunting sounds, not unlike human subjects kowtowing before a king. The alpha male strives to maintain social harmony within his troop. When two individuals fight, he will intervene and stop the violence. Less benevolently, he might monopolize particularly coveted foods and prevent lower-ranking males from mating with the females. When two males are contesting the alpha position, they usually do so by forming extensive coalitions of supporters, both male and female, from within the group. Ties between coalition members are based on intimate daily contact, hugging, touching, kissing, grooming, and mutual favors. Just as human politicians on election campaigns go around shaking hands and kissing babies, so aspirants to the top position in a chimpanzee group spend much time hugging, backslapping, and kissing baby chimps. The alpha male usually wins his position not because he is physically stronger, but because he leads a large and stable coalition. These coalitions play a central part not only during overt struggles for the alpha position, but in almost all day-to-day activities. Members of a coalition spend more time together, share food, and help one another in times of trouble. There are clear limits to the size of groups that can be formed and maintained in such a way. In order to function, all members of a group must know each other intimately. Two chimpanzees who have never met, never fought, and never engaged in mutual grooming will not know whether they can trust one another, whether it would be worthwhile to help one another, and which of them ranks higher. Under natural conditions, a typical chimpanzee troop consists of about 20 to 50 individuals. As the number of chimpanzees in a troop increases, the social order destabilizes, eventually leading to a rupture and the formation of a new troop by some of the animals. Only in a handful of cases have zoologists observed groups larger than 100. Separate groups seldom cooperate and tend to compete for territory and food. Researchers have documented prolonged warfare between groups, and even one case of genocidal activity in which one group systematically slaughtered most members of a neighboring band. Similar patterns probably dominated the social lives of early humans, including archaic Homo sapiens. Humans, like chimps, have social instincts that enabled our ancestors to form friendships and hierarchies, and to hunt or fight together. However, like the social instincts of chimps, those of humans were adapted only for small, intimate groups. When the group grew too large, its social order destabilized and the band split. Even if a particularly fertile valley could feed 500 archaic sapiens, there was no way that so many strangers could live together. How could they agree who should be leader and who should hunt where, or who should mate with whom? In the wake of the cognitive revolution, gossip helped Homo sapiens to form larger and more stable bands, but even gossip has its limits. Sociological research has shown that the maximum natural size of a group bonded by gossip is about 150 individuals. Most people can neither intimately know nor gossip effectively about more than 150 human beings. Even today, a critical threshold in human organizations falls somewhere around this magic number. Below this threshold, communities, businesses, social networks, and military units can maintain themselves based mainly on intimate acquaintance and rumor mongering. There is no need for formal ranks, titles, and law books to keep order. A platoon of 30 soldiers, or even a company of 100 soldiers, can function well on the basis of intimate relations. With a minimum of formal discipline. A well-respected sergeant can become king of the company and exercise authority over even commissioned officers. A small family business can survive and flourish without a board of directors, a CEO, or an accounting department. But once the threshold of 150 individuals is crossed, things can no longer work that way. You cannot run a division with thousands of soldiers the same way you run a platoon. Successful family businesses usually face a crisis when they grow larger or hire more personnel. If they cannot reinvent themselves, they go bust. How did Homo sapiens manage to cross this critical threshold, eventually founding cities comprising tens of thousands of inhabitants and empires ruling hundreds of millions? The secret was probably the appearance of fiction. Large numbers of strangers can cooperate successfully by believing in common myths. Any large-scale human cooperation, whether a modern state, a medieval church, an ancient city, or an archaic tribe, is rooted in common myths that exist only in people's collective imagination. Churches are rooted in common religious myths. Two Catholics who have never met can nevertheless go together on crusade or pool funds to build a hospital because they believe that God was incarnated in human flesh and allowed himself to be crucified to redeem our sins. States are rooted in common national myths. Two Serbs who have never met might risk their lives to save one another because they both believe in the existence of the Serbian nation, the Serbian homeland, and the Serbian flag. Judicial systems are rooted in common legal myths. Two lawyers who have never met can nevertheless combine efforts to defend a complete stranger because they both believe in the existence of justice, laws, human rights, and the money paid out in fees. Yet none of these things exist outside the stories that people invent and tell one another. There are no gods in the universe, no nations, no money, no human rights, no laws, and no justice outside the common imagination of human beings. Okay, take a minute to digest that a little bit. Now, I know those of you listening to this podcast, he just said there are so many different things that don't really exist outside of our collective imagination. Now, most of you listening to this podcast, well, maybe I shouldn't say most, at least some of you listening to this podcast won't agree that there are no gods. Personally, I don't agree that there's no gods. I mean, obviously, I'm basing my life upon that. But think about some of these other things. Nations don't exist. Money doesn't exist. Human rights don't exist. Law doesn't exist. Justice doesn't exist. All these things that we think of as virtues, these are things that are in our collective imagination. That doesn't mean they're false. That just means that when you think of it in terms of an animal kingdom, when you think of it in terms of physical reality, these are stories. These are things that we imagine together. And outside of our imagination, they don't exist. Monkeys don't have law. On the African savanna, between lions and gazelles, there is no justice. There's just food. Turn that one around a couple times. Let's keep going in the text. People easily understand that primitives cement their social order by believing in ghosts and spirits and gathering each full moon to dance together around the campfire. What we fail to appreciate is that our modern institutions function on exactly the same basis. Take, for example, the world of business corporations. Modern business people and lawyers are in fact powerful sorcerers. The principal difference between them and tribal shamans is that modern lawyers tell far stranger tales. The legend of Puglia affords us a good example. An icon that somewhat resembles the statue Lion Man appears today on cars, trucks, and motorcycles from Paris to Sydney. It's the hood ornament that adorns vehicles made by Puget, one of the oldest and largest of Europe's car makers. Puget began as a small family business in the village of Valentigny, just 200 miles from the Stadel Cave. Today, the company employs about 200,000 people worldwide, most of whom are complete strangers to each other. These strangers cooperate so effectively that in 2008, Puget produced more than 1.5 million automobiles, earning revenues of about 55 billion euros. In what sense can we say that Puget SA, the company's official name, exists? There are many Puget vehicles, but these are obviously not the company. Even if every Puget in the world were simultaneously junked and sold for scrap metal, Puget SA would not disappear. It would continue to manufacture new cars and issue its annual report. The company owns factories, machinery, and showrooms, and employs mechanics, accountants, and secretaries, but all these together do not compromise Puget. Do not comprise Puget. A disaster might kill every single one of Puget's employees and go on to destroy all of its assembly lines and executive offices. Even then, the company could borrow money, hire new employees, build new factories, and buy new machinery. Puget has managers and shareholders, but neither do they constitute the company. All of the managers could be dismissed and all its shares sold, but the company itself would remain intact. It doesn't mean that Puget SA is invulnerable or immortal. If a judge were to mandate the dissolution of the company, its factories would remain standing, and its workers, accountants, managers, and shareholders would continue to live, but Puget SA would immediately vanish. In short, Puget SA seems to have no essential connection to the physical world. Does it really exist? Puget is a figment of our collective imagination. Lawyers call this a legal fiction. It can't be pointed at. It is not a physical object, but it exists as a legal entity, just like you or me. It is bound by the laws of the countries in which it operates. It can open a bank account and own property. It pays taxes, and it can be sued and even prosecuted separately from any of the people who own or work for it. Puget belongs to a particular genre of legal fictions called limited liability companies. The idea behind such companies is among humanity's most ingenious. ingenious inventions. Homo sapiens lived for untold millennia without them. During most of recorded history, property could be owned only by flesh and blood humans, the kind that stood on two legs and had big brains. If, in 13th century, France John set up a wagon manufacturing workshop, he himself was the business. If a wagon he'd made broke down a week after purchase, the disgruntled buyer would have sued Jean personally. If Jean had borrowed 1,000 gold coins to set up his workshop and the business failed, he would have had to repay the loan by selling his private property, his house, his cow, his land. He might even have to sell his children into servitude. If he couldn't cover the debt, he could be thrown into prison by the state or enslaved by his creditors. He was fully liable, without limit, for all obligations incurred by his workshop. If you had lived back then, you would probably have thought twice before you opened an enterprise of your own. And indeed, this legal situation discouraged entrepreneurship. People were afraid to start new businesses and take economic risks. It hardly seemed worth taking the chance that their families could end up utterly destitute. This is why people began collectively to imagine the existence of limited liability companies. Such companies were legally independent of the people who set them up or invested money in them or managed them. Over the last few centuries, such companies have become the main players in the economic arena, and we have grown so used to them that we forget that they exist only in our imagination. In the U.S., the technical term for a limited liability company is a corporation, which is ironic because the term derives from corpus, body, in Latin, the one thing that these corporations lack. Despite their having no real bodies, the American legal system treats corporations as legal persons as if they were flesh and blood human beings. Are you getting this? This is wild, isn't it? I never even thought about this before. These things exist only in our collective imagination. If you think about this spiritually, you can think about the spirit of a place, the spirit of an organization. What if that's what it means? That these are things that exist in our collective imaginations. Back to the text. And so did the French legal system back in 1896 when Armand Puget, who had inherited from his parents a metalworking shop that produced springs, saws, and bicycles, decided to go into the automobile business. To that end, he set up a limited liability company. He named the company after himself, but it was independent of him. If one of the cars broke down, the buyer could sue Puget, but not Armand Puget. If the company borrowed millions of francs and then went bust, Armand Puget did not owe its creditors a single franc. The loan, after all, had been given to Puget, the company, not to Armand Puget, the Homo sapien. Armand Puget died in 1915. Puget, the company, is still alive and well. How exactly did Armand Puget, the man, create Puget, the company? In much the same way that priests and sorcerers have created gods and demons throughout history, in which thousands of French curés were still creating Christ's body every Sunday in the parish churches. It all revolved around telling stories and convincing people to believe in them. In the case of the French curés, the crucial story was that of Christ's life and death as told by the Catholic Church. According to this story, if a Catholic priest dressed in his sacred garments solemnly said the right words at the right moment, mundane bread and wine turned into God's flesh and blood. The priest exclaimed, "Hoc est corpus meum," Latin for "this is my body." And hocus pocus, the bread turned into Christ's flesh. Seeing that the priest had properly and assiduously observed all procedures, millions of devout French Catholics behaved as if God really existed in the consecrated bread and wine. In the case of Puget S.A., the crucial story was the French legal code, as written by the French Parliament. According to the French legislators, if a certified lawyer followed all the proper liturgy and rituals, wrote all the required spells and oaths on a wonderfully decorated piece of paper, and affixed his ornate signature to the bottom of the document, then hocus pocus, a new company was incorporated. I love how he mixes the metaphors. Do you see what he's doing? He's saying that it's all the same thing. He's saying that all this imagination, these things that we used to call sorcerers, these things that we used to call wizards, that's what businessmen are today. These things of legends, it's just same thing as we have today. In fact, what we have today is much more wonderful and amazing. Back into the text. When in 1896 Armand Puget wanted to create his company, he paid a lawyer to go through all these sacred procedures. Once the lawyer had performed all the right rituals and pronounced all the necessary spells and oaths, millions of upright French citizens behaved as if the Puget Company really existed. Telling effective stories is not easy. The difficulty lies not in telling the story, but in convincing everyone else to believe it. Much of history revolves around this question: how does one convince millions of people to believe particular stories about gods or nations or limited liability companies? Yet when it succeeds, it gives sapiens immense power because it enables millions of strangers to cooperate and work towards common goals. Just try to imagine how difficult it would have been to create states or churches or legal systems if we could speak only about things that really exist, such as rivers, trees, and lions. Over the years, people have woven an incredibly complex network of stories. Within this network, fictions such as Puget not only exist, but also accumulate immense power. The kinds of things that people create, or the kinds of people things that people create through this network of stories, are known in academic circles as fictions, social constructs, or imagined realities. An imagined reality is not a lie. I lie when I say there is a lion near the river when I know perfectly well there is no lion there. There is nothing special about lies. Green monkeys and chimpanzees can lie. A green monkey, for example, has been observed calling, "Careful, a lion," when there was no lion around. This alarm conveniently frightened away a fellow monkey who had just found a banana, leaving the liar all alone to steal the prize for itself. Unlike lying, an imagined reality is something that everyone believes in, and as long as this communal belief persists, the imagined reality exerts force in the world. Man, y'all need to read this book. If this is not blowing your mind, I don't know what will. This is just completely mind-altering to me. The sculptor from the Stato Cave may sincerely have believed in the existence of the Lion Man guardian spirit. Some sorcerers are charlatans, but most sincerely believe in the existence of gods and demons. Most millionaires sincerely believe in the existence of money and limited liability companies. Most human rights activists sincerely believe in the existence of human rights. No one was lying when in 2011 the UN demanded that the Libyan government respect the human rights of its citizens, even though the UN, Libya, and human rights are all figments of our fertile imaginations. Ever since the cognitive revolution, sapiens have thus been living in a dual reality. On one hand, the objective reality of trees, rivers, and lions, and on the other hand, the imagined reality of gods, nations, and corporations. As time went by, the imagined reality became ever more powerful, so that today the very survival of rivers, trees, and lions depends on the grace of imagined entities such as the United States and Google. So you see how he's pacing this. It's not, so this is something in my fundamentalist upbringing. If I would read something like that, this is the danger of the fundamentalist upbringing. It puts you in a little box and you can't investigate certain ideas because they're dangerous, because they're heretical, because they're not okay, because they're false. But what he's saying here, he's putting the idea of God in the same place of imagined reality as corporations and nations. Do corporations exist? Yes. Do nations exist? Yes. Do they exist the same way that trees and rivers and lions exist? No. It's much harder to comprehend these things. It takes this collective imagination, like he's talking about. But like he just said, they're not lies. It's not saying that they're falsehoods. A myth and a falsehood are two completely different things. All right, let's head back to the text. Bypassing the genome The ability to create an imagined reality out of words enabled large numbers of strangers to cooperate effectively, but it also did something more. Since large-scale human cooperation is based on myths, the way people cooperate can be altered by changing the myths, by telling different stories. Under the right circumstances, myths can change rapidly. In 1789, the French population switched almost overnight from believing in the myth of the divine right of kings to believing in the myth of the sovereignty of the people. Consequently, ever since the cognitive revolution, Homo sapiens has been able to revise its behavior rapidly in accordance with changing needs. This opened a fast lane of cultural evolution, bypassing the traffic jams of genetic evolution. Speeding down this fast lane, Homo sapiens soon far outstripped all other human and animal species in its ability to cooperate. The behavior of other social animals is determined to a large extent by their genes. DNA is not an autocrat. Animal behavior is also influenced by environmental factors and individual quirks. Nevertheless, in a given environment, animals of the same species will tend to behave in a similar way. Significant changes in social behavior cannot occur in general without genetic mutations. For example, common chimpanzees have a genetic tendency to live in hierarchical groups herded by an alpha male. Members of a closely related chimpanzee species, bonobos, usually live in more egalitarian groups dominated by female alliances. Female common chimpanzees cannot take lessons from bonobo relatives and stage a feminist revolution. Male chimps cannot gather in a constitutional assembly to abolish the office of alpha male and to declare that from here on out all chimps are to be treated as equals. Such dramatic changes in behavior would occur only if something changed in the chimpanzee's DNA. For similar reasons, archaic humans did not initiate any revolutions. As far as we can tell, changes in social patterns, the invention of new technologies, and the settlement of alien habitats resulted from genetic mutations and environmental pressures more than from cultural initiatives. This is why it took humans hundreds of thousands of years to make these steps. 2 million years ago, genetic mutations resulted in the appearance of a new human species called Homo erectus. Its emergence was accompanied by the development of a new stone tool technology, now recognized as a defining feature of this species. As long as Homo erectus did not undergo further genetic alterations, its stone tools remained roughly the same for close to 2 million years. Do you see what he's saying here? So he's making the distinction in evolution between genetic evolution and this cognitive evolution that we have. This cognitive, you think about genetics, the evolution of genetics is extremely slow because it only changes between generations. And I mean, honestly, even if you think about ideas, even if you think right now, the reason that we change so slowly ideologically, I would even posit that the only reason that we make major shifts is because one generation falls away and the next generation comes. Each generation seeks to get out of the shadow of the previous generation. And it has increased quite a bit recently. In recent years, in the past couple hundred years, especially in America, when the individual, get down, cat. Sorry about that. It has changed in the past couple years with the advent of America, where the individual is raised above all else. But still, major changes take time. Major changes take the falling away of previous generations and the rising up of new generations. If you look at the generations right now, we've got the baby boomer generation, my generation, Generation X, and the millennial generation. And there's extreme difference. I'm not going to go into differences that I see in the generations, but there's significant generations. And my generation, Generation X, can see, they either will identify going back to the baby boomers or going forward to the millennials. But the baby boomers and the millennials tend to have a very hard time seeing eye to eye because they're so different. In the same way, what he's talking about right now, this genetic change takes thousands of years. Small, little alterations over long, long periods of time. But when you're talking about a cognitive revolution, this only happened, what were the years he was saying, 70,000 years ago? As opposed to millions of years? When you think of billions of years the world has been around and millions of years that Homo sapiens have been around, 70,000 years is nothing. And then 70,000 years in and of itself is nothing. And then the whole of recorded history, 10, 15,000 years, just a blip on the radar. Printing press, 500 years ago. See, these are the things when you study history and you start to gain perspective, you see what an amazing and wonderful place we really are in. And the amazing time that we live in today. Back to the text. In contrast, ever since the cognitive revolution, sapiens have been able to change their behavior quickly, transmitting new behaviors to future generations without any need of genetic or environmental change. As a prime example, consider the repeated appearance of childless elites, such as Catholic priesthood, Buddhist monastic orders, and Chinese eunuch bureaucracies. The existence of such elites goes against the most fundamental principles of natural selection, since these dominant members of society willingly give up procreation, whereas chimpanzee alpha males use their powers to have sex with as many females as possible and consequently sire a large proportion of their troops young, the Catholic alpha male abstains completely from sexual intercourse or raising a family. This abstinence does not result from unique environmental conditions such as severe lack of food or want of potential mates, nor is it the result of some quirky genetic mutation. The Catholic Church has survived for centuries, not by passing on a celibacy gene from one pope to the next, but by passing on the stories of the New Testament and of Catholic canon law. In other words, while the behavior patterns of archaic humans remained fixed for tens of thousands of years, sapiens could transform their social structures, their nature of their interpersonal relations, their economic activities, and a host of other behaviors within a decade or two. Consider the resident of Berlin, born in 1900 and living to the ripe age of 100. She spent her childhood in the Hohenzollern Empire of Wilhelm II, her adult years in the Weimar Republic, the Nazi Third Reich, and Communist East Germany, and she died a citizen of democratic and you know what? I just realized just how far I think this is already my longest episode. I'm sorry, guys. I'm going to cut it right here. You got the idea of what's going on. These ideas that happened in the cognitive revolution, where the reason that we are able to change, the reason that we are able to have such dramatic change is because of ideas, things that don't really exist. Oh, it's such an amazing thing to even think about and to consider. But with that said, I am way past my time, and I apologize for doing that. But you know what? This is one of those things, you know? This is about a voice being heard, a voice crying in the wilderness. And if that's what it is, that's what it is. So I'm going to close up here with just a few things. If you appreciate this show, I would appreciate if you would take some time and become a Patreon. Become a patron of mine. You can go to patreon.com/John Weldy. Patrons give, you can give a small amount per month, as little as $1 per month. There's different amounts that you can support the podcast on, and you will enable this podcast to continue and hopefully not be as long as this episode has been. If you want to know more, I encourage you to go to my website at reclaimingchristianity.net. I have things up there such as my free book program where I give books to people all over the country. All I ask is that you help with the shipping costs. I have a lot of great deals I'm able to get on used books, and so I want to kind of spread the love. So go to my website, reclaimingchristianity.net, and click on free books. Special announcement for listeners of this podcast only. I do want to start a Reclaiming Christianity book club, the first book discussion club that we're going to do. It's going to be based on the book, Marcus Borg's book, Evolution of the Word. This is the New Testament in the order that it was written. Now, there is some debate on what order the New Testament was written in, but this is in the order the New Testament was written, according to Marcus Borg's decades of research. And reading in this particular order with some commentary by Marcus Borg, who is one of the most wonderful Bible scholars that you will find, it will lead to a different idea, a different picture of what the New Testament is. If you're interested in being a part of this, just let me know. You can go to reclaimingchristianity.net. You can talk to me on Facebook. You can send me an email at johnweldy@gmail.com. This book club will only be 3 to 5 people. You will be responsible for buying the book yourself. And there will be significant reading assignments. So we'll go through the entire New Testament, and I would just love to see what would come of it and talking about this with just a few people that are really interested in this. So with that, I am going to let you guys go. The book, once again, is Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. I hope that it's whet your appetite just a little bit on how amazing this book is and just on how amazing it just is to get out of your comfort zone and think about new, crazy ideas. Learn. I want to sign off by saying just a couple things here. I want to tell you that the most beautiful thing you can ever be is you. Do what you love. Love what you do. Thanks for listening.